Chapter 10. Restless. The storm continued into the small hours. After midnight, the thunder diminished into a background grumble, but the downpour increased, beating at the walls and roof like timpani. It felt as though the whole mountainside would wash away in a deluge of mud and take Helter Fortress with it. "I'm going to do a sweep," said Max. In truth, she needed to clear her head. She was beginning to fall asleep over the charts. A circuit would clear her drowsiness. Vorier and Jaff barely looked up from their work to acknowledge her comment. Drusha had already retired. To his bed, Max presumed. She buckled on her uniform jacket, picked up her riot gun and a Plastec slicker, and left the library. The fortress was silent, except for the drumming rain and the constant spattering chime of the roof leaks spilling down into pans and buckets. Everything smelled damp. Only a few lamps and candles had been left along the galleries and staircases, so Max fished out her stablight. On the second floor, she saw Medea Betancourt on a bench outside the chamber reserved for Eisenhorn. Betancourt was working through a data slate. She looked tired.
"Anything, Marshal?"
she asked, as Max approached. Max shook her head.
"He's sleeping at last,"
said Betancourt, tilting her head towards the chamber door.
"He needs it."
"You need it too, ma'am," said Max.
"In a while, perhaps," replied Betancourt. "I'll stay here for now, in case he needs me. The dreams wake him."
Max nodded. Betancourt returned to her data slate, and Max made her way back to the stairs. She went down to the main entrance, pulling on her slicker. Nail had set up lighting rigs in the yard on their arrival, and she could see their white glow backlighting the small windows above the door. She dragged the door open. The yard was bathed in harsh white light from the rigs. Where the heavy rain caught in their stark glare, it made dark stripes like vertical interference bands on a picked feed. Max could hear the chatter of the portable generator running the rigs, a murmur behind the constant snake hiss of the downpour. She saw Nail across the yard by the gate. Edda was with him, and they had the main gate dragged open a yard or two, so they could look out into the night. Max hurried across to them, the rain pattering off her Plastec shroud. The air was cold and fresh. She already had water running down the back of her neck.
"Anything?"
she asked. Nail glanced at her, water dripping off his solid chin.
"Something tripped the outer senses about half an hour ago," he said. "Probably just an animal, but Garifar and Cronil are checking."
"Should I get everyone up?"
she asked. He shook his head.
"Probably just an animal," he repeated.
"Keep me advised," she said. "I'll sweep the house."
Max returned to the main building. She heaved the heavy door shut and shook off her slicker. She checked the kitchen, then the small back parlor. The fire there was still burning, making it the most comfortable room in the place. Drusha was asleep in an armchair. He hadn't gone to bed after all. He'd brought books down from the library, and one had fallen open across his chest as sleep claimed him. A book on migration habits in the Carinines. Max saw delicate line drawings of wildfowl. She closed the book and set it aside, drew Drusha's old coat across him as a blanket, and, as an afterthought, bent down and kissed him on the forehead. He stirred slightly, mumbled, and went back to sleep. Max had just entered the main hall when she heard the voice. It sounded like a cry. Not a cry of pain, but an urgent call, like someone far away shouting an order. She halted, listening. The hall was empty, and the candles had burned out. She heard the odd call again, in the distance, muffled by the rain. This time, when it came, her vox set squawked simultaneously, as if echoing the cry. Max adjusted the collar-mounted set. It emitted a quick squeal, then a harsh flood of static.
"Mr. Nail," she said, tipping her head to talk into the mic. "Mr. Nail, this is Marshal Max. Do you copy?"
Static fizzled.
"Nail, come back. This is Max."
There was a burble of audio noise, and then she heard Nail's voice.
"Reading you, Max."
"What was that?"
asked Max.
"That noise?"
"Affirmative."
"Not sure,"
Nail's voice crackled back.
"Garifar and Cronil just got back to the gate. Cronil thinks it was an animal cry."
"Your vox go weird?"
asked Max.
"Yeah, just for a second,"
Nail replied.
I think it's atmospherics. We've just got rain here now, but I can see some fierce electrical displays further down the valley.
Max wasn't convinced, but she knew how the storm had played hell with Vorier's uplink before midnight.
Stay in contact, she said. I'm going down to the cold store, then I'll walk to the west wall.
Channel open,
Nail responded. Max opened the cellar door and followed the stone steps down into the undercroft. There was no light except for her powerful stab beam. Then her eyes began to detect a faint blue glow. The door to the cold store was ajar. The glow of the stasis fields was shining out into the hall.
Nail, she said into her mic, the door to the cold store is open. Has anyone been down here?
Static burbled back.
Nail, respond.
Just more oddly modulated interference. Max waited for a moment. She wanted to move in with backup, but she didn't want to leave the door open, and she'd have to if she was going to go and fetch Nail and the deputies. She locked her stab light onto the underrail of her riot gun and moved forwards, aiming the light beam with her weapon. The door hadn't been forced. The bolts were on the outside, and they had been drawn back. Slowly, she eased the door open a little wider with the muzzle of her gun and peered in. The whitewashed chamber was lit by the blue ghost light of the field units. The gurneys sat in rows, green plastic sheets over the remains. Over 17 of the gurneys. One, in the middle of the rows, was empty. The plastic sheet was crumpled on the stone floor beside its wheels. One of the bodies was gone. Max cursed under her breath. She edged forwards and slowly settled down into a crouch so she could peer under the rows of gurneys and play her stab light around. Nothing. No heap of bones on the floor. And how did a bundle of bones fall off a gurney anyway? Max rose again slowly, her weapon raised and ready. She realized she was breathing hard, and she forced herself to slow the rate. She backed gently to the doors and stepped out into the corridor.
Nail,
she whispered into the mic on her collar. Still nothing. She braced her weapon with one hand and pushed the cold store door shut, resetting the bolts. Something beside her screamed. Max jumped in shock and wheeled around, her weapon leveled. Her heart was racing. There was nothing there. She circled, hunting the length of the corridor both ways with her powerful beam. Nothing. The scream came again.
Thrown!
She spat. It was her vox. Her damn vox. It was squalling and yelping, uttering shrill bursts of audio wash.
Nail!
She snapped, gripping the collar unit with one hand.
Nail, respond!
She headed back towards the stairs to the main hall.
Nail, someone's been into the cold store. There's a set of remains missing. Nail!
Static fluttered. She half heard her name, scrambled by the interference.
Nail, do you copy?
Marshal, say again.
Nail, the cold store's been opened. A body's gone.
Copy that.
Nail's reply was masked with noise.
Meet me at the entrance, she barked.
Silence.
Nail?
She reached the main hall and closed the cellar door. For a moment, she thought she saw someone standing at the far end of the hall, a figure in the shadows. But as soon as she turned her stab light that way, it was gone. Just her imagination. She got herself spooked. Her mind was playing tricks. She headed for the front entrance, but changed her mind and switched down the side passage to the parlor first. Drusha was still sound asleep in front of the hearth.
Valentin?
She shook him.
Valentin!
He woke up, bleary.
What? Is it... What?
Something's going on, she said. Get up!
What?
He asked, blinking.
What sort of something?
I don't know. Something.
He got to his feet, his limbs stiff.
You look scared, he said.
Just get your coat on, she replied.
Germaine, why are you scared?
Drusha asked.
Shut up and get your coat on, Magas, she said. We're going outside.
He struggled into his coat. She could see that she'd alarmed him. He wasn't properly awake, and everything was an effort.
One of the bodies has gone, she said.
He looked at her.
Gone? In what way?
In a not-there-anymore way, Drusha. I just checked the cold store. A body has gone.
Taken? He asked.
Well, of course. How else would a body disappear? Someone's in the house.
You've seen?
I haven't seen anything. But someone must have come in. Hurry up!
He followed her to the door, and they went out together into the kitchen passageway. There was someone at the far end, by the hall door. "Mr. Nail!" Max called out. She raised the stab beam. She'd found the missing body. It was standing up, a twisted skeletal figure, caked in dirt and black organic tatters. It began to limp towards them. Certain things had trailed Valentin Drusha around his whole life. Poverty was one. Frustration was another. A lack of confidence. A wounded sense of being overlooked. All of those things had visited him on an intermittent basis. But fear had been, pretty much, a constant companion. Drusha's fear took many forms. Sometimes it was abstract, like his fear of failure, and its ugly, contrary twin, his fear of success. He was afraid of authority, and afraid of being forgotten. Mostly, his fear manifested as a simple fear of pain. He was a nervous, timid man who lived in dread of a midnight knock at the door from a predatory road mob, or of getting in a fight when he was minding his own business, or of being dragged away and beaten by law enforcement if his papers weren't up to date. He was afraid of heights and of drowning. He was afraid of being hurt. A lingering early memory was the fear of the aggressive canine his father had kept, a creature that never seemed to tolerate Drusha. During his long years of training and education, he had lived in perpetual anxiety about being bitten or stung or clawed by the lab animals and wild specimens he was examining. Even as a Magos, that fear had persisted, making him tentative in his work and his studies. He knew a lot about animal behavior, and, for the most part, he knew how to avoid the risks and handle potentially dangerous life forms. But the most basic rule of all was that even a Magos biologist never knew everything, and that an animal, especially one trapped or surprised, could do the unexpected. The damn sea raptor had remained in its cage for months because he'd been too afraid to get near to it. Twice in his life, he had faced things that were truly fearful. The unholy Xenos specimen that he and Max had cornered in a mill in Outer Udar years before, and the psychotic killing thing he had hunted in Tycho City. Those fears lived with him and woke him at night, even though the dangers had long passed. They were hard-edged fears, and they tasted bitter, like dirty iron pressing on his tongue. They made his pulse skip and his skin go clammy. They made him dull and stupid, as if fear were a weight that pressed common sense and logical response out of his head. Both of those truly fearful experiences had happened when he was in the company of Jermaine Max. She was like a damned jinx that made bad things happen to him, not insane adventures. That was a euphemistic, jolly term that suggested thrills and excitement. Just bad things. Things that had put him in the path of genuine, violent extermination. Things he didn't wish to repeat or even remember. The closest he'd ever come to death. But there, in the kitchen passageway of Helter Fortress, with Max's stab light, yes, Max there yet again, the common denominator of his misfortune, with her stab light illuminating the ghastly and impossible as it hobbled towards them, he oddly felt no fear at all. The figure was simply unbelievable. Old human bones, mottled and stained by loam and mildew and decay, roughly assembled in anatomical order, scabbed and crusted with mould and dried black blood and residual masses of dead sinew and tissue. The empty eye sockets were dark pits of shadow. For a moment, time seemed to dawdle, as if waiting for Drusha's mind to catch up. He became aware of how not frightened he was. Perhaps he was simply denying what was in front of him, refusing to accept it. Perhaps it was just so extraordinary it had taken him beyond the limits of any fear he could register. Perhaps the day had already been too strange. He had been forced to accept things that his scientific background did not allow for. The workings of the psychanic mind, the notion of speaking to the dead, the post-mortal apparition of an old man. He had, for Throne's sake, shaken hands with a ghost. Perhaps the strange day spent in the company of Eisenhorn and his curious band of assistants had acted as a crash course, a steep learning curve into the truths of the unknown. Perhaps the day had been like a baptism, annealing his soul and his fear so that it was ready for this moment. Or perhaps it was just too fascinating. Drusha's curiosity, the appetite for wonder and discovery that had steered him into his profession, had eclipsed all fears. Even the Xenos thing he had faced in the windmill all those years ago, that had been definable. He'd been able to know it, to describe it in accurate terms. He'd been afraid of it simply because it had been going to kill him. But this was beyond his considerable framework of knowledge. He wanted to know what it was. He wanted to understand how it could be, how it could exist. It was just organic waste, the skeletal relic of a dead human being. It had no life. It was a broken frame that had once supported life, but that was all. Even on a basic level of organic engineering, the greater part of the mechanism was missing. There were no muscles or tendons left to support or move the bones, no blood supply to feed those muscles, no nerves to stimulate motion and control balance, no heart to pump the blood, no organs to fuel the process, no brain in that cranium to make walking a desire, no eyes to see them with. But it saw them. And it walked, a precarious, slow walk like a frail old man. It saw Valentin Drusha and Germaine Max, and it walked towards them. "That," Drusha said, almost brightly, "that is highly unlikely." Max mumbled something that wasn't properly a word. The approaching figure appeared to shudder slightly. Drusha realized that the powerful stab beam transfixing it was quivering. Max's hands were trembling wildly. He could hear her sobbing and hyperventilating. He knew, under any other circumstances, he would be doing the same thing. His mind would have closed down in the choking paralysis of fear. "Germaine," he said gently. "Germaine." He put his arm around her shoulder. She was shaking so badly it felt like she was vibrating. She was making an odd mewling sound. She couldn't not look at it. Drusha couldn't look away either, but he reached out with his free hand and took the riot gun from her, keeping the stab light aimed at the walking thing. He squeezed his arm tight around her quaking shoulders. "Germaine, come on," he said. "Come with me. Take a step backwards. That's it. And another." He edged them towards the parlour door. She shook against him. Drusha could smell the thing advancing towards them. He could smell rot, not the gross, gagging stink of putrescence, but the faded, dry fragrance of end-stage decomposition. "Germaine, another step." They had reached the parlour door. He pushed Max into the room, and she almost fell through the doorway. Drusha turned back to face the walking thing. "What are you?" he asked. "Can you speak?" "You shouldn't be able to, but then you shouldn't be able to walk either. Can you tell me what you are? Can you tell me how you are possible?" The figure could not. It simply continued its inexorable trudge towards Drusha. Its right arm began to rise, as if it were reaching out to touch him. "I'd like an answer," said Drusha. "If you won't answer, or you can't, I'd like you to go." By the light of the torch fastened under the barrel of Max's heavy weapon, Drusha saw that some kind of energy discharge was crackling over the walking bones, like a faint bioluminescence. It was an electric green, which reminded him of deep-sea leechfish, or the cave worms, Nematodus cryptus, that he had catalogued in southern Gersha. The glow came and went, never totally present. For a moment it shimmered around arm bones, and he saw the brief, ghostly traceries of veins and capillaries. He saw phantom tendons and intercostals come and go across stained ribs. He saw spectral organs pulse in the abdominal void. Some kind of energetic pattern, a light echo of the lost soft organics. Green pinpricks lit in the empty orbits of the skull sockets, the ghosts of eyes. "If you don't answer, then we're done," said Drusha. "This will be good night. I won't allow you to come any closer. I have a gun. It will shatter what little is left of you." The skeletal thing took another wavering step closer. "I warned you," said Drusha. Very calmly, he thumbed off the weapon's safety, braced it in a low grip because he knew it would kick, and fired. In the tight confines of the passageway, the boom was deafening. The blast hit the figure in the sternum. The explosive force dissipated like steam. Drusha heard flecks of shot patter onto the stone floor, all force spent. The figure kept coming, as though nothing had happened.
"Thrown," said Drusha. He charged the pump grip and fired again, then repeated quickly. Each shot blew out like vapour as it reached the advancing thing. Only now did fear begin to register in Valentin Drusha. He felt it creep into his joints like frost, numbing him. He got the first taste of bitter metal on his tongue. He fired one more shot, then ran into the parlour and slammed the door.